Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries.
Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 37. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. I've been out of the country for a while, about 5 weeks, and this is the first show released in about 6 weeks. First off, before I go any further, I'd like to thank the people who sent donations while I was in the hospital in Peru. Without all of your help, our return here would be short-lived. Max, once again, thank you. Max sent a rather large donation while I was in Peru, which was very helpful, and an additional donation last week or so. Also, Roman, Dharma Awakenings, Travis, Mark, Garth, Eric, Gennaro, Matthew, Kenneth, and Byron, thanks to all of you for your donations and anyone I missed. Hopefully I didn't miss anyone. Also, thanks to everyone who ordered a copy of one of the books or the DVD from the website while we were gone. That was most helpful. I'd also like to thank my friend Don for mailing all of those orders out for us during our extended trip. Don has his own medical issues he's been fighting with, and he made it to the post office and got those orders out to everyone on time each day, so thanks to him. Today, instead of the usual interview format, I'll be speaking with Richard Andrew Grove and Lisa Arborcheski of Eighth Estate Media and Tragedy and Hope magazine about my trip to Peru, my experience with the medical system there, and some brief and sometimes not as in-depth comparisons as they should be, but I'm trying to show the contrast between the two cultures. Hopefully, we cover enough to not be offending to anyone. But those of you out there who are seeking good and affordable health care, dental care, etc., I think you'll appreciate this show. At least I hope so. And speaking of medical care, if anyone out there has suffered similar circumstances regarding stomach issues and are in need of a good doctor, during the show we discuss my treatment in Peru under Dr. Carlos Ortiz at Clinica Arequipa in Arequipa, Peru. So if you're in need of a good doctor but can't afford the U.S. medical care system, please feel free to contact me and I'll make sure to get you Dr. Ortiz's contact information. The cost for the medical care I received in Peru would have cost somewhere between $60,000 to $80,000 here in the U.S., but how much did these Harvard University-trained doctors in Peru charge me? Less than $2,000, and that was without insurance and included the prescriptions, consultations, and other expenses. And the question must be asked, exactly what are we paying for when we pay for American medical insurance and American medical care? And in my case, they didn't resolve the problem and misdiagnosed me for the last 13 years. And we'll also discuss the Peruvian dental system, the American diet and obesity, cultural differences, and the similarities between the Catholic and Inca religions, and a few other items. Some of you may be shocked to discover that the Inca and Catholic beliefs are not so different after all. And upcoming shows, I've got a few people lined up, hopefully for the rest of August. And so let's see, who do we have? We've got Steven Zerlinga of the American Monetary Institute. I hope to get Acharya S on, as well as Steven Hager from High Times Magazine. Also, possibly coming up in the near future, Michael Tsarian and David Icke. And David Icke should be coming on late this month to discuss the New World Order, Zionism, and entheogens. And I know I've bashed him in the past publicly, but it's one of my mottos to always hear people out and hear their own research from their own perspective and study what they've got. So I'm giving David Icke the opportunity to present his information. And recently, some of the research that I've been doing has been crossing paths with some of his in some areas. I don't agree with all of it, especially the lizard thing, but anyway, I thought I would have him on and that it would be interesting to hear him out, and which I mentioned before I left. Also, please don't wait for someone else to donate. It's your support we need. We now have in the ballpark of about 45,000 to 55,000 listeners a month, and that means for about every 12,000 listeners, one or two of you donates, and several of those are regular donators, but this while we were gone in Peru, we did have several new donators, so that I already mentioned, and thanks to all of them. But whether you can donate $2 or $50 or whatever you can, please don't hesitate to make a donation and go to www.gnosticmedia.com. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C media.com, and click on the donations button at the top left of the page. And also thanks to everyone who has been helping with the transcriptions of these shows. That has been a huge help. We can still use more volunteers for this project. I'd like to get those done as soon as possible. So if you can help with a transcript or two, please contact me right away. The transcripts will be going into a book project where each person who helps will be acknowledged. But not only that, these transcripts and the book will also be being stored at Purdue University Special Archives indefinitely, which is the same facility that stores Amelia Earhart's papers, amongst many other famous researchers. So maybe you'd like to get your name in print for helping save this information for future researchers and scientists who will have access to these shows and this information for hundreds of years to come. You can also support the show by ordering a copy of the DVD or one of the books or the She Who Remembers audio archives from the www.gnosticmedia.com website. And because of the extended hospital stay in Peru and the lack of shows being released recently, sales were way down. So if you've been thinking about ordering a book or a DVD, please do. We can really use your support, orders, donations, etc. And yes, I hate to beg for donations and support for each show, but sometimes humility is the best medicine. And also from now on, I will be offering each show on CD or DVD. So if you would like an actual copy of the show on disc, I'll be making those available for a $15 donation for domestic orders or a $20 donation for orders outside the U.S. And I still have copies of Astrotheology and Shamanism, the color version. I've got less than 32 of those numbered and signed color copies remaining. And I was giving people a nearly 30% discount on the color DVD combo by sending everyone a free copy of the DVD with their order. But due to lack of funds, as I mentioned before, we left for Peru, that we cannot send those DVDs out for free anymore. But what I'm doing is I'm still ordering or offering those for about a 55% discount off the DVD price if you want to get that with a combo order. So basically, instead of $21 for the DVD, that you're getting it for about $9.50. But I can only continue that offer for the last 32 copies remaining. You can also get yourself a copy of ANS in black and white for about $21 plus shipping and handling. I also have copies of my last book, The Holy Mushroom, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity, available. Those do go out autographed in appreciation for your support. And hopefully those will become a collector's item for you, as the first edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism has, selling for over $100 a copy now. The views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself or Gnostic Media. Once again, the website, www.gnosticmedia.com, or you can contact me directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. I hope you enjoy the show. And this is Gnostic Media's podcast number 37. And since I haven't had a show for the last 4 or 5 weeks, I thought I would do something a little bit different. Today I'm going to be talking with Richard Andrew Grove and Lisa Arborcheski about my experience in Peru and the medical care there, and just different ideas and contrasts between the two societies and cultures and things like that. And I think a lot of people out there can benefit from getting an understanding of the differences between the medical care systems and the healthcare systems and politics and things like that in our country versus Peru. And so anyway, Rich, Lisa, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, and we're so glad to have you back stateside, man. And that the whole trip, you know, if it had to happen to anybody, at least it happened to you, who have the words and the nomenclature and the will to articulate your experiences and share them with an audience who very much needs to hear what you have to say. So thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
and Rich, you were actually on podcast number one when you and I went to with Paul to Carl Ruck's house. So this isn't your first time on the show either.
It's not my first time on the show, and our recording history goes back way before this podcast started. So happy to see that podcast number 38 is revved up and ready to go. And
37.
Oh, I was already talking about next week. My bad. Obviously, you and your family were hanging out in L.A. doing your thing, and your wife is from Peru and hasn't been back in many years. And you had a short trip planned back to Peru to see her family, and it turned into something more of a exploration and discovery tour of yourself and other cultures, and a comparison and contrast between life here in America and life and what it could be like in other countries.
Yeah, and this wasn't my first trip overseas. I had lived in Europe for a year and a half back in the 90s, so I kind of had a grasp on different cultures from that aspect, but you know, this was a good refresher course, so to speak. And you know, it was sort of a good refresher course and reminder about the differences in cultures and how we sort of get acclimated to our own culture and we forget about, or often people, if they haven't been to other cultures and societies, often don't even realize how different they are, yet so similar. And you know, so
well, in your situation, your experience was special in my mind because you were in quite a vulnerable, you found yourself in a very vulnerable state of health while you were down there and had a life-altering near-death experience.
Well, you know, basically, as I mentioned on my podcast before, I had ongoing stomach problems, and we decided, you know, since the healthcare is so expensive here, and I had been going through the healthcare system here for 13 years with very minor results and inaccurate diagnoses and things like that, with an ongoing problem with my stomach. Basically, doctors here in the U.S. primarily just wanted to prescribe me drugs and label it as IBS or irritable bowel syndrome or stress or something like that, and then give me pills for it. So initially, before we went down there, we decided it would probably be a good idea to find a doctor down there and see what we could get done while we were down there. And so we were there for a couple of days, and Claudia's family knew a couple of doctors, and they called them and got some referrals for a gastroenterologist, which is a stomach doctor, basically. And so we got a referral to this very good doctor, Dr. Carlos Ortiz from Clinica Arequipa, which is a private clinic up in, or down in actually southern Peru in the desert area. And so we went and saw him, and things sort of
went from there into a trip into the hospital for almost a week and being properly, for the first time in many years, properly diagnosed for my stomach problems and getting treatment down there, both starting in the hospital and then 2 weeks after, they, you know, the doctors requested that my flight back to the U.S. be delayed so that they could finish treatment before I left. And so we ended up extending the trip for 2.5 weeks, which ended up going from June 24th all the way up until we got home on the 28th of July. So it was more than a month. So
you must have had, like, do you mind if I ask? I mean, you must have some super fucking duper healthcare plan to get, you know, treatment like that you couldn't even get in the United States, right?
Well, you know, and that's just it. That's what's so important to talk about. And a lot of people have seen the movie Sicko, and it brings some of these things to light, where they took some of the people from the 911 Trade Center, their rescuers, and they took them down to Cuba in a boat and got them medical treatment. In Peru, they have both public and private medical centers there. The public ones are basically anybody can walk in and get free treatment, which I could have done, but it would have taken longer, probably wouldn't have been as clean, and you know, you'd have to wait in long lines with everybody else. But this doctor that we were referred to was at a private clinic, so we had gone there to see him anyway. And then basically what happened is, when I went in to have the scopes done on my stomach and intestines, for the second scope, I had on the same day come down with the flu, and my body didn't have any nutrients in it to fight the flu, and it laid me out, and so they had to admit me into the hospital, into the emergency ward for you know, for treatment, because I had just finished the scopes, and then they wanted to check and make sure that, you know, also that it wasn't a problem with that or anything. But they ended up keeping me in the hospital for 5 days there, and they started doing all the tests and everything, and figured out exactly what was going on as compared to the American medical system. And what I should say is that for the 5 days in the hospital, plus all the medications and the treatment and the doctors and the specialists and the lab tests and all of that stuff, my total bill was about $780, and for just the hospital stay, plus there were other expenses with the outpatient treatment and things like that, that was ended up being about $2,000 total. But just the 5 days in the hospital here in the U.S. would have cost about $50,000. And so down there, you're looking at $80 or $90 a day. So, you know, I've got friends with here in the States with similar stomach problems, and they've been battling doctors and things, getting it properly treated, and HMOs, they don't want to pay for the specialists, so they, you know, they give you these poor treatments, or they want to just prescribe drugs so the doctors make a commission off it and stuff like that. Down there, the doctors aren't making a commission off the drugs, and in fact, most drugs, you can walk into any pharmacy and tell the pharmacist what you need, and they'll give you the drugs without seeing a doctor first. It's pretty much down there, you're an adult, and you're responsible for yourself, and if you're stupid enough to take pharmaceutical drugs that are going to be really bad for you, then you know, then that's your risk and your responsibility. And you know, it's very similar. You know, Mexico has the same thing, where you can walk into pharmacies and buy most pharmaceutical drugs just right over the counter. But you know, pharmacists are doctors anyway, and down there, the pharmacists ask you, you know, they talk to you and try and figure out, you know, what's going on, or if you have a cold, they'll give you antibiotics for the flu or whatever for that time, and maybe something to stop the runny nose and the coughing. And but you know, things down there are much more just open. In fact, the medications down there for the most part are typically anywhere from 50% to maybe 10% of the cost as drugs here in the U.S. So drugs that were that I needed for the outpatient treatment that were $300 a box in the U.S. We were able to find the highest price was like $50 a box, all the way down to $15 a box. So, you know, they're more into curing and not making such a huge profit off of the medical treatment and off of bogus diagnoses and off of the pharmaceutical drugs and things like that. So
they're not trying to make you a lifetime customer. They're trying to.
Exactly. You know, and speaking of that, it was actually when I mentioned to the doctor there that they had wanted me, or that the doctors in the U.S. had told me that I had to take these drugs every day for the rest of my life. That was actually what began to clue him in on what was going on, because suddenly he was like, you know, what? You know, repeat that? They want you to take what every day for the rest of your life? And he's like, you know, I've been in this business for years and we never recommend people to take anything for the rest of their lives. And, you know, instead of trying to maintain you and keep you in the system so that you have to buy these drugs and see your doctor to renew the prescription every 6 months or a year, down there, their goal is to get you cured and get you out of there for good. They don't want to see you back for the same problem.
Right. So you went to some doctors in the LA area. You also went to see this doctor in Peru. What's the difference between what he told you in Peru and what the doctors have told you, you know, exclusively around, you know, normal hospitals in the United States?
Well, the last doctor I went to, and I don't remember the name off the top of my head, otherwise I would say it because, you know, I have very little respect for the guy. But basically the last doctor I saw in Simi Valley, he told me that I had been to, you know, he looked over my medical records and told me, well, you've been to 9 or 10 other doctors in the past and they didn't find anything. So I don't know why you think I should be any different. It was basically his attitude, or that, you know, that if they didn't pinpoint the problem, that it was nothing that he could do, and that he was diagnosing me with irritable bowel syndrome and here's a prescription and get out of his office.
Well, I think that what you're describing is a behavior set forth by physicians. It's also prevalent within our society, which is when faced with something that you don't know the answer to, you feel threatened by it and you want to deny it and say, well, I can't help you, instead of being interested in saying, yes, let's check this out. This is something I don't know the answer to either. It's a health problem for you. It would behoove us all to figure this out, right?
Right.
And the guy, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think, you know, part of the doctor's issue was I told him, you know, I felt like the past doctors had treated me like a machine. I didn't want to be treated like a machine. I wanted to be treated, you know, to try and figure out, go through the routine and try and figure out what exactly was the problem. And, you know, I think he felt threatened by my statement. But, you know, afterwards, actually, earlier this year, I did see a naturopathic doctor. And he was actually, out of all the doctors I saw in the U.S., he was actually one that really, excuse me, really began to figure out what was going on. And he put me on some homeopathic treatments for parasites and stuff like that. And then after a couple of weeks when that didn't work, he's like, okay, this is what I think is going on, but because I'm not a medical doctor, I can't treat you further. So, you know, here's what you need to do. And so, you know, that was kind of the mindset when I went to the doctor in Peru. And, you know, so, you know, and I told him everything that I had been through and the treatment that I had gotten. And, you know, my doctor from Peru, Dr. Ortiz, he had actually had treatment training here in the U.S. at Harvard University as well. So, you know, he's trained down there. He's also trained in U.S. medicine by America's Finest Schools, and he comes up once or twice a year and does training here in the U.S. as well. So, you know, it's very interesting that I have to go to Peru to find a doctor that's even trained in the United States to treat me and diagnose me properly.
It's really ironic that there are schools here that could teach doctors how to heal us and to make us healthy and make us make us aware so we can live a preventative lifestyle and not constantly have to be chasing after illnesses that we've gotten and we don't even know what the root cause is, right? It's that the system here, because it's profit-based, instills, you know, all these other motives that come to the surface only when profit's involved. And profit in and of itself is not bad. It's the extreme forms of profit that HMOs, and, you know, this came in with Nixon and the Kaiser Foundation in the 70s, as shown in Kevin Booth's film American Drug War, right?
Right, exactly.
And so whether it's Michael Moore's movie Sicko or Kevin Booth's movie American Drug War, these things all interlock, because the drug war is also about the pharmaceutical companies that are paying off your doctors and basically turning guys in white coats into guys who are pushing drugs and getting commissions on those drugs.
Right, and failing to do their job properly. You know, it actually becomes very depressing when you think about how far away America, the United States, you got to consider South America as America too, how the United States has just moved so far away from the great country that we claim to be, you know. And I kind of began to realize when I was in Peru that the U.S. has really become the butt of a big joke, and everybody's laughing, but the Americans don't even know it. I mean, you know, we also got, my wife and I got a lot of dental care taken care of when we were down there. Some of it was pretty grave that needed to be done, that, you know, just things that were going to be more than $10,000 for treating here in the U.S. And we were able to get her treatment down there for under $500. And, you know, so in a way, you know, it seems more logical for me, because the reason why we didn't go down to Peru before is because of my stomach issues. And when my son was born, we were paying $600 to $800 a month to, you know, for my copay for the medical insurance through my company. And, you know, the company that I was working for at the time. And so we didn't take this trip because we didn't have the money, because we were paying $800 a month into medical care and all of this stuff, you know. And then after being in Peru, you know, it seems wiser to me in many ways, except for maybe trauma care, to keep enough money saved up for an airline ticket and $2,000 or $3,000 additional, so that if there's ever a medical emergency or you need to be treated for something, you have enough money for an airline ticket and treatment like I had in a foreign country, because that same treatment in the U.S. is going to cost you $5,000 or $10,000 a day, and down there you can get it for $80 a day, and it's the same treatment, if not better, down there. And the dental treatment, you know, my wife was treated by the professor of dentistry at Arequipa University, as well as the former president who had just resigned about a month or two ago from the Peruvian Endodontia Association. So he's the top guy in the country, or two of the top guys in the country treated us, and it was, you know, under $500 to get everything treated that would have been enough to buy a new car or put a down payment on a house here. And so, you know, when I hear, you know, and I've known a lot of people over the years who've told me that they go down to Mexico for dental treatment and things like that, and I was always kind of, well, you know, isn't that kind of dirty? They probably don't have the latest equipment. And now I realize that that's a bunch of BS, that not only do they have the best equipment, but often the doctors and the dentists are better. You know, the last time I went to the dentist here in the U.S., I had to go back three times because he did a filling wrong, and it was still done incorrect, because the doctors and the dentists in Peru had to fix one, or actually a couple of my fillings that they didn't cure right here and never set right. So and down there, they got it fixed properly on the first try, and no pain whatsoever, and unlike the U.S. dentist, and I was out of there in a couple hours. So, you know, it's to the point of absurdity. You know, when you know, these healthcare systems, these healthcare companies in the U.S. are just such gigantic middlemen, and they're hyperinflating the costs of everything. You know, when you live in a country like that, you've got the free hospitals, but even the private clinics are affordable. And people are so worried about here in the U.S., oh, well, if we had socialized medical care, there would be long lines and all that. But you would still be able to go to your own private doctors and private clinics whenever you wanted. And not only that, when you get rid of the insurance companies in the middle who are charging these outrageous fees and everybody's worried about lawsuits and everything because everything is so messed up here, you know, get rid of the middlemen and things might actually work. You know, I think Peru's medical system is a great example of, and probably there are many others out there, certainly where when I lived in Yugoslavia, they did the medical care the same way with the public and private clinics, and even the private were completely affordable. And in fact, at one time in the public clinic, I had to go to the actually went to the emergency room 1 week 5 times, and for stomach issues, and this was about 10 years ago. And they apologized to me at the end of my treatment and said that because I wasn't a Yugoslavian citizenship, it's now Serbia and Montenegro, but because I wasn't a Yugoslavian citizen, that they had to give me a bill. And I'm like freaking out, and they're like really apologizing, and we're so sorry, and you know, this isn't normal, we don't usually have to give a bill, but because you don't have a Yugoslavian passport, we have to. And so anyway, I go up to the front counter, and I'm kind of stressed out, thinking it's going to be, you know, $1,000, $2,000 or more. And they give me the bill, and it was $90.
Wow.
And so, you know, I mean,
the system that we have in the U.S. is, as you and Rich said earlier, a form of parasitic capitalism, right? Wherein the system is working for the cartel capitalists, the pharmaceutical companies, et cetera, the entire establishment, in the sense that when you cannot afford preventative health care, et cetera, then you become a lifetime patient of theirs and user of their pharmaceutical drugs, et cetera.
An addict
of the system. And what you're describing to me, it sounds like from everything you've told me about Peru, the healthcare system there is a reflection of their culture and their values.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, and, you know, another interesting thing that a stark contrast when you first get to Peru, and this was the same in Yugoslavia and Greece and Hungary and other countries where I visited back in the 90s, but there is no obesity in Peru. And I may have seen one person that I would consider obese in Peru in the 5 weeks there. And he was probably a tourist. But, you know, what was interesting is we would see people getting off the buses and things when we were in different towns. And you could always spot who were the Americans because they have ridiculous hairstyles, often
they're
wear
flashy.
Polyester, but yeah, or they wear a lot of gold and stuff like that. But the main thing was, is that the Americans were always fat. I mean, you could always spot them because they were always way overweight. You know, and you might have some Peruvians that are a little bit pudgy, but you don't have fat people, and you especially don't have obese people, where the U.S. has people that break records of, like,
I was just going to say
800 or 1,000 pounds, so they win they get to go on Oprah Winfrey or something and feel sorry for themselves to the whole world, you know.
So in Peru, what you're saying is they never have to cut the roof off a house, bring in a crane, and bury some guy inside a piano case.
Because he's so full of corn syrup and hydrogenated fats.
Right. He's not right. Sitting in front of a TV. He's not eating fast food from these corporate restaurants every day. They're walking. They're talking. They are, you know, communicating with people. They're having meals with friends. They're having organic, homegrown food. And they're not sitting in front of a bunch of boob tube stuff all the time, right?
Well, yeah, for the most part, you know,
it's not because they're super people, right? That's what I'm getting to. It's not a racist thing. It's a
they do have the TV channels. In fact, are almost the same as here. Lima, which is Peru's capital, does have McDonald's and Pizza Huts and Kentucky Fried Chickens and stuff like that. But
the people that keep it real. The people there don't take it seriously as we here in America who believe everything we see on TV. The people down there have history and they've got walls to show you the difference between their culture and the conquistadors.
Yeah, very true. And but, you know, that's a whole other part of the discussion we can go into later. But, you know, they don't, you know, just like in Europe, McDonald's is going out for dinner. It's not something that you go to the drive-thru every day on your lunch break or dinner.
Or breakfast, you know? Yeah.
And, you know, in Arequipa, there were no McDonald's, no Burger Kings. They did have, I think there was a Kentucky Fried Chicken in Arequipa, but none of the fast food restaurants were in Cusco.
Well, and how many kids going to school every day were stopping at McDonald's and getting Chicken McNuggets or hash browns or any of the other stuff that American kids traditionally now feed themselves with because they're all latchkey kids for the most part?
Yeah, and, you know, what's interesting there is also, you know, the food is all fresh pretty much every day. I mean, you see the trucks rolling in at 5 o'clock in the morning, going to all the markets, carrying all the fresh meat that was just slaughtered during the night. I mean, it's fresh, and most of the meat and stuff there never sees a freezer. You know, here you wrap it up in a nice little package, you put it in the freezer, and people are totally removed from the death aspect or the life and death aspect of eating and what it, you know, life requires death, whether it's vegetables or plants or animals. Life requires death. That's how it is. It's part of the balance of nature. But there, they're not removed from it. You know, there it's like, you know, you have to face it. And what I also found interesting is that in Peru, when you order a steak, the meat slices are very thin. They're usually like a quarter to maybe a third of an inch thick, where it's And they're just the right size to where it fills you up and you feel totally satisfied, but you're not stuffing yourself. You know, we mentioned to people, you know, how in the U.S. a steak is usually a half inch to an inch and a half thick, and they would just, like, why? That just sounds disgusting. Why would you even want to put something like that in your mouth? But not only that, but when it's cut thinner, it brings out more flavor, and that's what they want because their meat tastes better. You know,
right, and that's where, you know, foods like fajitas come from. It's a part of the cow, this belt around the cow that has this meat, where if you cut it really thin, it works out great. But here in the States, it's a big status symbol to get some 4-inch thick steak and make that part of your body that you're going to be carrying around in your colon and your gut for a long time. But we don't think. We just think, how cool is it to go out and eat a big steak dinner and stuff baked potato, and it's cost $150, right? It's a big dinner out for the year, and we're celebrating it. And it's like the worst meal we have, and we value it for all the wrong reasons. And that's all we're saying is, look at the reasoning. That's the difference in cultures.
Yeah, you know, and there, you know, these smaller cuts of meat, it tastes better. It's just enough. You know, it's you know, you should have, like, if you're a meat eater, like 6 ounces in a meal. That's probably about the average size cut, is about 6 ounces, and then you eat that with vegetables and with, you know, potatoes, and they've got 4,000 different types of potatoes in Peru.
Wow.
And, you know, a couple of hundred different types of corn. And, you know, we have
Monsanto. We have Monsanto corn here.
Yeah, white and yellow corn, and they're these little tiny kernels. And down there, the kernels are about a half inch big. You know, and it's like, yeah, what's going on with our corn, with our food, you know, when, you know, it. And that was the same when I lived in Central Europe, too, is the food was always fresh. The vegetables and fruits tasted better. The same thing in Peru. Very stark contrast between the two societies. America's everything for profit. Remove yourself from the death aspect so you don't even think about that you're eating a dead animal. Oh, it's a hamburger. You know, people put down people that go hunting or go out and get their own meat off of a farm, their own lamb or whatever. But, you know, that's, to me, a lot more respectable because you're actually facing the life that you're taking, and you're a part of the whole ritual, so to speak, of cleaning it and, you know, storing it and having to do what, people did with their food for thousands of years that suddenly Americans are so far removed from, that it, you know, that beef is a red thing that comes from the freezer section at the grocery store and has no relation to any animal whatsoever.
Well, and they completely remove themselves from the idea of like what their body even needs. They don't even think about, am I eating something that my body needs that is going to give me the fuel and the energy that I need for good health, for my immune system to function properly and all these other things. I mean, people just generally have lost touch, right? They've lost touch with that. And so fresh fruit and vegetables and fresh meat, these things are not important. They think that they're getting fuel when they go to McDonald's and they get processed foods. And really all they're doing is further taxing an already taxed system.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and another thing that is in stark contrast in both Europe and Peru, South America, is family and community and so-called family values. The whole notion of family values is lip service to a political agenda.
Right.
Whereas in Peru and in South America and in Europe, family are the people that you actually take care of first. You know, whereas, you know, in the United States, they kick you out when you're 17 or 18 years old. You're expected to immediately be an adult and be out on your own, and then you're bombarded.
Well, you're expected to go get credit, right?
Well, that's what I was just going to say. You know, you're bombarded with credit card company applications, and you know, and then you get yourself in 50 or 60 grand worth of debt going to college, so that before you're even really an adult, before you can even function in society, you've got all of this debt and all of these things that you know, are going to trail you for the next 20 years of your life. And
that disempower you and keep you from becoming self-sufficient.
You know, we never had in Peru, we never had any trouble finding family or even strangers to watch our son for a couple of hours whenever we needed to go run errands or whatever. Even like when we were in Cusco away from Claudia's family, people at the hostel where we were staying were offering to watch him for us while we went out and had dinner. Or, you know, it's just a very
different
society.
Didn't Gianmarco wander off at one point?
Yeah, at one point Gianmarco wandered off, and when we were packing, and all of a sudden it was quiet. We went out looking for him, and we see him walking down the street with the maid from the hostel. She's holding his hand, bringing him back, and oh, you know, he was crying. He wanted to go with me, and you guys were busy packing, so they walked down like five or six doors down the street to pick up some stuff, you know, some supplies for the hostel, and come back, you know, and it was like, oh, you know.
An ordinary day for her.
Yeah, an ordinary day for her. And you know, people were just laughing when we came back in because we were all freaked out. And they're like, you can't lose your kid in this town. You know, they're like, you know, just relax. You know, this town, everybody knows everybody. And don't worry, you know, just go with it. You know, and so it was like, you know, because here everything is about fending for yourself. And there it's, you know, you fend first for your family, next your next door neighbors, and you help take care of them.
It's cooperation instead of competition.
Yeah.
It's not keeping up with the Joneses. It's when we help each other and we empower each other, we can accomplish things that are greater than ourselves.
Right.
And people,
you know,
probably
and then,
have a much more, a higher quality of life as a result.
Well, yeah, they do have, there's definitely a higher quality of life there, which is in stark contrast to the concept of a quote-unquote third world country. And, you know, the same thing is true when I lived in Yugoslavia during the war. Even though the U.S. had had them under sanctions for 10 years and their economy went from one of the best in the world to one of the worst, they still had a better quality of life and a better standard of living than we do here in the U.S. And
well, it's not, you know, the United States can't have a higher standard of living or a higher quality of healthcare. It's not enough people understand the mechanisms of why our system is this way versus what other systems can be and how our system can grow into being something reflective of what we all want and need instead of what they can sell us for the most profit.
Right. And, you know, it's just, you know, and I don't want to bash too hard on the U.S. I'm just trying to get across the differences and some of them that I think the U.S. could honestly do better on. And there's obviously areas that Peru and certainly Yugoslavia at the time could have done better on. I was there when Milosevic was president. But it certainly was nothing like what the media here portrayed of the entire situation. In fact, generally the opposite of as I've written on my website. But, you know, there's just so many stark contrasts between the societies and the family structure. And like I said before, family values. In these countries, they actually have family values, whereas here it's just all political lip service. And you know, you go out and you bash the gays and you bash this group and that group as, oh, you know, God is going to crash down on America because we're allowing gay marriages and stuff like that. And, you know, we have to protect our family values. Well, what are these guys being married to each other and having their own private life really have to do with your family and your family values, except for your own insecurity? And, you know, it's... You know, in fact, as far as the society is concerned, to allow gay marriage is actually safer because typically that means that people are going to be dedicated to each other and less promiscuous, which means it's going to lower the likeliness of the spread of disease.
Well, let's look at who spread ideas like that, like Reverend Ted Haggard, who was leading like 40 million evangelical Americans. And he's been in one of a variety of movies, including Jesus Camp. And, you know, I'll think of it in a second. But the point being, it's hypocrisy that most of those people who are pushing values are spreading, because Haggard's actions were drastically different than that he was trying to enforce on other people. You've got people Bill Frist, who was in the government up till recently. Or he might still be there. But, I mean, in his part of the country, they tell kids that you can get AIDS from tears and pregnant from masturbation, you know? And so there is all sorts of misinformation going on around this country and has been going on. And I think those of us who realize, you know, what's going on to various levels, including, you know, everyone who's listening to this podcast, it's our responsibility, if we recognize this, that, you know, we need to do something to communicate it to other people such that they can better understand it easily, you know, without having to do so much research and watching so many things, you know, as a foundation. We need to be able to boil it down and condense it and show people that, you know, basically all the problems that we're describing, it's not, you know, I'm not trying to hate on America. Yes, we have some problems with our healthcare, but we love it enough that we're putting some energy into figuring out how we can improve these things, right? Comparison and contrast allows us to build a better picture. And the idea is that we don't any longer have to sit around and wish for solutions to, like, you know, come out of nowhere. The solutions are there. What's keeping everyone from figuring out is recognizing that the original war, the only war that's gone on since the beginning of time, is the war on consciousness. And as long as there's a war on consciousness, it's, you know, it's going to continue to fester all sorts of problems. War, the drug, you know, war on drugs, the war on terrorism, all these different problems, right? And your work, more so than anyone else I know, exemplifies that point, because you started with, you know, the war on consciousness, and now we're working down to the point where we're figuring out the subversion of our own educations in this country through, you know, not only the educational system, but the media system, the political system, the economic system. All these shortcomings come back to, they don't want us to know as much as them, because then we might play at an equal level.
Very, very much so. And since you brought up the point of drug war, I should mention coca, which in Peruvian society is standard protocol, like hamburgers, cheeseburgers, and apple pie here in the United States. On the airplanes, they serve coca tea. On the buses, they serve coca tea. When I was in the hospital for the 5 days, I was given 3 pots of coca tea to drink a day. And why is that? Because coca helps with digestion. It's also rich in vitamins. And it also helps treat a high altitude sickness. And half of Peru is above 8,000 feet. You know, some of the towns that we visited were over 12,000 feet.
Now, what's the difference? Excuse my ignorance, but what's the difference between taking some coca leaves and steeping it in hot water for a couple minutes and making tea versus the highly refined cocaine that you see the CIA putting on the streets of America for the past 20 years?
Well, the difference is it's, like you said, refined and chemically, but You know, the leaves have been used by the indigenous people in Peru for thousands of years for when they would work in the fields, and especially at the high altitude levels, because it really helps fight off the high altitude sickness. And you know, if you get headaches or dizziness and things like that when you're up at the high elevations, the first thing they do is give you coca leaves to chew on or coca tea, you know, and they even recommend when it's really cold up at the highest altitudes to shove coca leaves in your shoes.
So since you've gotten back, have you had to, like, knock over a liquor store to get your fix of coca leaves? Or, like, what's the deal? Are you hooked on it now or what?
No, not at all. In fact, you know, pretty much even when they were, you know, except for when they were giving it to me in the hospital and requiring me to drink it for the nutrients to help rebuild, you know, it's actually a lot better for you than coffee. It's a lot more gentle on the stomach. And, you know, I think maybe one day I had 3 cups of coca tea, maybe 4 during the whole day. I know people that have 3 or 4 cups of coffee just to wake up in the morning. But, you know, it does energize you. It does bring you up a little bit like coffee, but you don't get the jitters with it.
Were you close to overdosing with 4 cups of coca tea?
No, not at all.
And, so if I hear you correctly, then it's only through the highly refined mechanisms brought forth by our intelligence agencies that makes it addictive, right?
Well, you know, in the early 1900s, late 1800s, cocaine was legal. Cocaine was legal to buy in the pharmaceutical in the pharmacies. And, you know, so the problem from cocaine, and sure, there were some people that were addicted to it back then when it was legal, but, you know, instead of creating hysteria, you educate people on it. And, you know, if they wanted to get rid of half the people in the jails and eliminate half of the health risks and all of the crime associated with getting crack and cocaine from addiction, from burglary and stuff like that, you legalize it and you put it in the pharmacies and you sell it for, you know, what it's really worth.
Well, that doesn't sound too profitable, man. I mean, what are you going to do with all the money that's generated by the black markets? I mean, prohibition.
Yeah, well, you know, when they make a kilo of cocaine down there for a couple of bucks and they sell it for $17,000 up here, you know, that gives you an idea of where the problem lies. And, you know, it gives the CIA a lot of leeway to make money to drive their covert operations and things like that. And I know, you know, John Loftus, I had him on the show, and he denied that really existed. But, you know, I don't necessarily agree with him on that point.
You could look at Gary Webb, who is a journalist in L.A.
Sure.
You could look at Danny Casolaro, who's a journalist. Who, you know.
Michael Levine is another one that's gone public.
Sure.
You know, and there was a cop or two in American Drug War that were, you know, that were in the video, you know, and on stage when we did the presentation in L.A. as well.
Well, and what about Celia Castillo?
Peter Dale Scott, just a professor at Berkeley. So there's a lot of people who've talked about and written about and documented the drug trafficking, and that can only happen when you have a black market, because prohibition puts the most ruthless people in control, which is a great reason that we should regulate.
Right, and not outlaw. Regulate it like alcohol. Alcohol kills more people except for cigarettes. Alcohol is the number 2 killer in the U.S. from medical related problems alone, not including 80% of all highway fatalities and rapes and murders. So, you know, but we still regulate it because prohibition was far worse, because all the criminals had control, and people still have a hard time grasping that. And, you know, if Americans think that flying a bunch of helicopters over Colombia and Bolivia and Peru are going to wipe out the coca fields and, you know, drive those evil coca farmers to their knees, they've got another thing coming. That would be like saying that Peruvians are going to come out here and wipe out obesity by blowing up all the McDonald's and preventing people from having apple pie and watching football and drinking beer on Sunday.
Don't take away my NASCAR!
You know, well, and it's exactly that. And don't take away their coca. And it's a core part of their culture. It's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. It's not going to happen. And Americans need to wake up to that. You know, if a politician is telling you that the solution to the cocaine epidemic is to fly helicopters over jungle and spray herbicides that also destroy the jungle, you know, that politician needs to be escorted and voted out of his job.
Well, and herbicides that are carcinogenic and creating cancers, et cetera, right?
Yeah, so it's... And polluting the, not to mention destroying ancient rainforests and things like that.
Absolutely. Well, where are our priorities?
Yeah, anything they can't patent, they like to destroy, right? That's their MO.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's why hemp's prohibited, because they can't patent it. And when they prohibit it, it creates an artificial space where DuPont and all these other synthetic fiber companies can grow up in its stead.
And, you know, and I think another problem with the whole cannabis thing is, you know, there's so many strains, and every week some grower is developing a new strain. Could you imagine Monsanto trying to hold on to one patented strain of cannabis, saying that it's theirs, when the whole industry changes breeds every other week? There's just no room for control there, because cannabis is all about mixing the breeds and coming up with new breeds and changing everything. Nothing is stagnant.
Except the Jack Harris strain. That'll be the same strain forever.
And if anyone out there has a seed of sugar rose, please let me know.
Well, what I found interesting was, even in the most recent studies, doctors at Harvard, the Harvard Cancer Center in Boston, they hope that drugs mimicking the anti-cancer effects of THC will someday help patients. That's what I read today in an article. Yeah. And I'm thinking, you know, the absurdity.
Yeah, you know, and here are Jack Hare and Rick Simpson, and they're just about to launch a European tour. They're going to go to Poland and Czech Republic and Slovakia and Hungary, and then they're going to be going to Holland somewhere in that trip as well to talk about cannabis and cancer curing, as my show and the scientific research proves on that subject. And you know, it's ridiculous. They're trying to come up with a patentable drug, and they want to remove the high, because God forbid you get THC in you and feel good, even though it's the THC directly on the tumor and cancer cells that kills the cancer cells while simultaneously protecting healthy cells.
Well, they don't want you to feel good, have a good effect from the THC, because they have too many nausea drugs and pain management drugs for that.
Yep, that's true.
Yeah, they don't want to see their sales go down.
You know, and if everybody started doing what Rick Simpson figured out and making THC bud essential oil extracts and applying it directly to skin tumors, or eating it for internal tumors and getting cured in a month to 2 months, and sometimes as little as 2 weeks. And, you know, and the studies are out there. The studies have been done by Denver University, by Dr. Robert Malamede and some of these people that...
Well, there's also Harvard studies and Johns Hopkins studies. I mean, and, it's been studies for 20 years they've known this.
But they're applying these cannabinoids directly onto the tumor cells. And, you know, the lie has been, and it's effective in brain tumors as well, and the lie has been that THC kills brain cells. Well, the opposite is true. What they found is that THC killed the cancer cells, not only protected the healthy cells, but helped generate new healthy brain tissue, and no other drug has shown that capability.
And they talk about Alzheimer's as well, in terms of repairing damaged cells.
And it's completely the opposite of what we're told, you know, and it's also been proved that if you have a stroke, if you smoke cannabis within the first 20 or 30 minutes, you dramatically lessen the damaging effects of the stroke on the brain. But, you know, how do you tell conservative Republican family members that they need to smoke a joint 20 minutes after a stroke to minimize the effects of it, or within 20 minutes? And it's just you know, they don't want to hear it, or you're just blowing smoke, you know, so to speak.
What is a great reason that everyone can have on hand to just print out that article and keep your joint in your wallet in case you have a stroke. You're going to need that 20 minutes afterwards, and that's what I would tell the officer. See what he reacts to that. I bet he hasn't heard it.
What's interesting, though, is cannabis is very illegal in Peru, as opposed to coca being available literally everywhere. Ayahuasca is completely legal, as is San Pedro, which is mescaline.
San Pedro, is that St. Peter, the rock the church was built on?
Yeah.
The conquistadors brought it back. Yeah. You know. Who named it San Pedro is what I'm asking.
Yeah, Trichocereus panicoi, which is a Peruvian cactus.
Now, did you mix any Banisteriopsis coppi with Psychotria viridis while you were down there?
No, I unfortunately didn't have a chance to do one of the ayahuasca journeys. We did find somebody towards the end of the trip that was had a little store there, a little shaman store, and he was offering a trip on the night that we were heading back to Lima, so we didn't end up doing that. But not only that, I had just gone through a couple of weeks worth of stomach treatment, and you know, and I know that ayahuasca is generally used to help treat stomach parasites and things like that as well. But considering how much hell I had just gone through, we decided it was better not to risk it. And
yeah, right on.
You know, we'll have to save that for the next time we go down there.
Well, I know that Camo from the Sea Realm podcast usually goes down to Peru during the summer for an ayahuasca journey, a couple weeks or a week or at a time.
Right. And, yeah, and
he didn't go this year. Yeah.
Oh, he didn't. I thought he was going.
I don't think he went this year. I don't think he's going this year, if I remember hearing in his podcast recently.
Yeah, that was from like the 11th or 12th of July until the 18th, and we were there when that was going on, but you know, with all the medical treatment and everything, we couldn't afford to get over there, so we just decided it better to get healthy than to go see more of the country. We would have loved to have seen the jungle. We pretty much stayed in, except for Cusco, we stayed in southern Peru, which is all desert area, but you know, next time we'll get back there and get to see Iquitos and some of the jungle and what we missed this time.
Well, I think maybe next year we should plan for Tragedy and Hope and Gnostic Media to take the HD cameras down there and capture that and bring it back and share it with our respective audiences, because it's something that you're not going to see on TV up here, right? It goes on every year. There's a lot of smart people down there exchanging ideas, but it's not too, you know, prevalently shared up here in North America.
Right. You know, and one thing, and I need to get going here pretty soon, but one thing that I wanted to go in before I cut it off was the contrast between Inca and Catholic religion. And
You mentioned the conquistadors and walls.
Well, no, I'm not talking about. I'll talk about that in a minute. But
okay.
You know, we took some photographs in front of the wall that Che Guevara in the Motorcycle Diaries, he's in front of this wall that this shows Inca and Spanish architecture on the same wall, and Che makes the comment of something to the effect of Inca capable and Spanish incapable, and you know, it's a huge contrast. We took a lot of photos of a lot of the Inca architecture and stuff, and it's just amazing. And the Spanish stuff is just clearly slop. But, you know, the Inca and Catholic religions, and it's really interesting, being in a Catholic country, and, you know, Yugoslavia was Orthodox, and so they had some idolatry, but South America, you know, I've never seen so much idolatry anywhere in all my life. Everything is about, frankly, worshiping pieces of wood and stone that are carved into little figures that that they believe in. But, you know, for the most part, the society is Catholic. There's a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons and other groups down there too, unfortunately. But, you know, when you're familiar with, the book that I wrote with Andrew Taji, Astrotheology and Shamanism, as well as the Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD, when you have that information in mind, and you go down to Peru and you go through the tours and you look at the temples, the sun worship temple and the sacred valley and these things like that, and a lot of the symbolism, they worshipped Virgo, the constellation. They worshipped I'm just trying to think of the morning star. Which one is that again?
Venus.
Venus.
So was it a mix of indigenous and traditional tribal beliefs along with Catholicism?
You could see, obviously, the Catholics usurped the indigenous, but you can see when you go through the tours and you look at the monuments and you look at how they describe everything, when you understand the astrotheology and the fertility and the drug aspects of Judeo-Christianity and shamanism in general, you look at the Inca stuff, and there's places where you can go today that they took down an Inca temple, like in Cusco. They knocked down an old Inca Sun temple, and they put a Catholic church right on top of it. And some of the old architecture is still inside the Catholic church. And you take a tour of all this stuff, and we've got photos of all of it, but you know, the tour guide is sitting there explaining to me a lot of this stuff, and you can read it in the books what they believed as well, and how they aligned everything on the solstice and the equinox, and they believed in certain constellations. They believed in the Pleiades, they believed in Venus and Virgo and the birth and death of the sun, and the fertility concepts and the seed and planting and the harvesting and everything regarding the crops. And the concepts of ayahuasca and San Pedro and the drugs that they use, it's clearly the same religion at its core. I mean, it's we were in the tour and Claudia and I were laughing at each other because all the stuff that they were saying, it's like, you know, the people, most of them in the tour being Catholic, you know, they think, oh, well, you know, the Spaniards saved those poor Indian souls, but we're over in the back and we're laughing because it's the exact same thing, only the Catholics slaughtered 15 or 20 million people, indigenous people, to steal their gold and to usurp their temples and to enslave their people.
And your comment that it's the same thing reminds me of seeing Maria Sabina, who is a part of Mexican Indians who survived because they lived in the mountains and were able to avoid the conquistadors, and seeing her do her mushroom ceremony, her veleda, that it's both like Catholic iconography, all these symbols of Catholicism, and yet she's still going with the thousands of year old tradition that the mushroom is Jesus, and to her it's all meshed together. And to see that video, it sounds exactly like what you were experiencing in Peru, or at least parallel.
Parallel, you know, not overlapped. And I mean, you can obviously see the overlap as well, especially in the architecture of some of the newer churches. Well, not newer, like from the 1600s, 1700s especially. But, it's really interesting because you can actually see the old religion and the old temple and the old buildings, and then you see the new religion and the new temple and the new building sit on top of each other, but they're still separate. You know, it's not this amalgamation yet. And so I found that to be very interesting, and just so interesting that these people in South America, the citizenry of South America, they just believe wholeheartedly in this Catholic religion. They're conquistador dominators who destroyed their culture and everything that they were about. They don't see it as being usurped. They actually believe, you know, for the most part, most of them, probably 90% of them, believe the Catholic propaganda still. And I find that to be in itself sort of disheartening and sad, because their own culture was, you know, I mean, and the Incas did their fair share of bad stuff and in slavery and warfare and things like that too. But, you know, to give up your own religious beliefs, even when it's still in your face every day, for the dominator culture's belief system, I just found that to be incredibly interesting and simultaneously disheartening. You know,
it's the same thing that happens with Native Americans in North America, though. I mean, a lot of them drop their indigenous and tribal cultures and take on that of the Western culture, and they're wearing Levi's and going to McDonald's.
Well, and several generations out, you lose touch.
Yeah.
You forget your roots.
Yeah, that's, you know, and that's true, too. And there is obviously a lot of people there that do still hold on to a lot of the traditional beliefs. But, you know, and then there's also the mix. You know, it's really interesting. And the Incas had their idols, and the Catholics are certainly not lacking in idols. There, you can't find a taxi in Arequipa that doesn't have some idol on the dashboard or hanging from the front mirror or stuck to the windshield. But, you know, there's so many more stark similarities. And, you know, like I said, anybody who's seen the Pharmacratic Inquisition video, in fact, the tour guide of the tour that we were on, I talked to him afterwards and told him, you know, hey, we should get together and do a documentary on the similarities between Inca and the Catholic religions. And, you know, and he was obviously Catholic and didn't take to it too well at first. And I started explaining to him, and I told him, you know, like the image from the video and from the book of Lady of Guadalupe or the Virgin Mary that shaped as the female yoni. And when I started explaining it to him, he got it. You know, he was just like, oh, yeah. You know, and...
he's seen a yoni before.
Well, it's always... Yeah. It's like the arrow in the FedEx. It's always been there, but you just never saw it quite like that.
Right.
Before.
You know, and it's like, you know... yeah, exactly. But, I hope he contacts me back. I gave him my business card and told him to watch the video on the website and let me know what he thinks, if he would be interested in doing something like that, because, you know, he was very well spoken and he could explain the detail of, you know, he obviously knew his history and kept up on the archaeological studies and things like that. So, you know, it'd be very interesting, whether with him or somebody else, to do something to show people how similar a documentary that shows how similar these cultures are and were.
Well, sure, they pray to idols that are wood and stone, and we pray to idols that are wood and plastic and glass, called televisions, right? Because there's a TV in basically every taxi, everybody's home, people sitting in front of it, watching it, waiting to be told what to do by their idol, right? That's why I'm a big fan of autodidactic activities, you know, read a book or go talk to somebody.
Well,
learn something.
Here in the U.S. it is, but down there, they're like I said, there's certainly no lack of idols anywhere. And they've got their, you know, your idol that you go and pray to when you're driving down the highway so that you don't get in an accident, and your idol for this, and your each city has an idol. And
well, and we have, you know, saints, right? Or not we, but the...
Well, yeah, you know, you call them saints, I call them idols, you know.
Sure.
It's basically people that were there, for the most part, that were slave drivers, and a lot of the fathers and the missionaries back then were, you know, they built these things off of slavery and off of just total annihilation of these cultures. And so, you know, you say saint, I say idol. I guess saint is probably more proper and less offending to some of the Catholics in the listening
now,
audience.
Doesn't, if memory serves me, the founding father of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam was Abraham, and his dad had a shop full of idols. And one day when Abraham was left to run the shop and his dad goes out, his dad comes back and says, what the hell is going on here? All the idols are smashed.
Well,
right?
You're talking about biblical history, and most Christians and Catholics don't read the Bible, so...
I thought it was just an anecdote. You're telling me that's some sort of history?
Yeah.
The one God smashed the others. That was the punchline. Yeah. That's monotheism in 30 seconds. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm familiar with the story.
You've been through a lot of character building turmoil over the last, you know, 6 weeks, and I'd like to thank you for sharing it, not only with us, but for giving your audience a chance to grow with you, instead of allowing that to become a chasm where they can't relate to you anymore, because now you're a little bit more calm, cool, relaxed, and comfortable with yourself after having a much needed treatment.
Yeah, well, thank you.
What I really mean is, it's good not to have to hear you complain about not feeling good, buddy. It's really good.
Well, you know, it's really good to not be in constant pain all the time or constant nausea or, you know, it feels really good. It feels good to feel human again.
Right, and to live life again, because it's like you're not really living it when you're constantly being pulled away and focusing on not feeling good and this pain that you're constantly feeling. So,
are you conscious right now?
Yeah. Right. And being in bed for a week or two, sometimes 3 weeks at a time when I'm not feeling well and stuff like that. So,
right.
Yeah, I think that's finally all in the past, and I'm still undergoing part of the outpatient treatment for the next couple of months, but hopefully after that everything will be in the distant past.
And podcast 38, which is coming up, we're gonna have some psychedelic talk back on there, because I think we're all jonesing for some good information.
Who's that?
I was asking if you had another guest lined up for podcast 38 that was actually going to talk about the topic on which this podcast is published.
Well, it's published under Gnostic or Gnosis, which is knowledge, so hopefully a little bit broader. But actually, I'd like to get Stephen Zarlinga from the American Monetary Institute on to talk about his book, The Lost Science of Money, which is a phenomenal read that somebody that listened to my podcast with
Gilbert Griffin
heard that and said, you know, contacted me and said, I had to read that book and sent me the money to buy it too, so I couldn't turn down the offer. And I'd like to get Daniel Siebert on to talk about Salvia Divinorum. I'm trying to get James Orrick on to talk about his new book, Tryptamine Palace, which is about 5-MeO-DMT, sort of a follow-up to my interview with Hallucius Nation. And hopefully one day I'll be able to get a hold of Chris Conrad and get him on to hopefully talk about hemp. I think that would be a fantastic show.
I think you should plan several episodes with Chris, maybe a couple weeks apart or whatever, but map it out, because he's got a lot of work that needs to be archived and shared in a reputable area where it's going to be available to people of, you know, observing minds.
And I can't forget to mention Paul Stamets. I still need to get him on the show, so... For those of you who aren't familiar, he's the famous mycologist, and if you do a search on Google for TED Talks, Paul Stamets, S-T-A-M-E-T-S, you'll have a little bit of a taste of what that will be about.
Really? He talks on TED? He's a mycologist? On... Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he learned his trade from magic mushrooms, too.
I was going to say, it's pretty impressive for what appears to be a New World Order type platform. I mean, the cutting edge technology that they show is all kind of neat. And, you know, most of the public thinks, wow, that's cool. But when you look at what they're doing with all those individual pieces and putting it together, it's not to free consciousness. Let me tell you that.
Yeah. I've seen some of it that kind of made me go, whoa.
Yeah.
But anyway...
Hey, well, you know, thanks for making time in your day to share with all of us, and good luck at your dinner tonight. And we just really appreciate having you share the experience so that we can all avoid the perils that lie within the healthcare system here. Save money, take a trip to Peru, man.
Exactly, and thanks for coming on the show. It's better to have friends to talk to than to sit here and try and describe it by myself for an hour. So a little bit different than the usual format, but hopefully people enjoy it nonetheless.
Well, and it's my pleasure because I get to participate a little bit, but I definitely learn a lot. So thank you.
There you go. And this concludes Gnostic Media Podcast number 37 with Richard Andrew Grove and Lisa Arborcheski. And make sure you check out www.tragedyandhope.com, the new magazine that they launched recently, and the name is based off of Carol Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, and he was a famous professor. Look him up, and then you'll know what Tragedy and Hope is all about, getting the truth out to the people, which actually Quigley was against. He supported the upper echelon, so to speak, rather illogically at times.
It's part of the coincidentia oppositorum, or the union of opposites that tragedy and hope brings. We're showing you both sides, letting you make your own decision, making it all available. That's our goal.
There you go.